If you've lived in Hanford in the last half century, there's a good chance you bought an appliance from him. But did you know he operated a much more expensive piece of equipment during World War II?
And I said, what's the matter? He said, look on the floor. And I looked over to my right, and I saw this hole in the airplane I could see outside.
What made that hole in his B-24? Well, you need to listen to Hometown Heroes today to find out for sure, or you can see a picture of it at KMJNow.com. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join me for Hometown Heroes today at 1 on News Talk 580 or 5 p.m. on FM 105.9 KMJ.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday on KMJ. You probably listen to us on KMJ AM at 1 o'clock or maybe on FM 105.9 at 5 p.m. Some of you are listening in online at KMJNow.com. But if you're a regular listener, you know that we like to catch up with World War II veterans and find out what it was like in that crazy time in world history. We want them to know how much we appreciate their service, the sacrifices they've made. We want their stories to live on. We want to preserve them. And we certainly learned quite a bit along the way. We're going to do that today with a guy who's going to be celebrating his 90th birthday in a few days in Hanford. August 7th, Ed Jones will be 90 years old. Maybe you bought an appliance from him at Driscoll's over the years. He only worked there for 60 years, so chances are if you're from Kings County, you probably did. But Ed, let's go back long before you ever knew what Kings County was. You grew up in two pretty big cities, New York and Chicago. And December 7th, 1941, you were in the Windy City?
I was in the Windy City working for a fast food place, and across the street was a Tribune Tower, and we saw smoke coming out of the windows at the top of the tower where the Japanese embassy were there, and a black car rolled up and pulled these people out of there in their underwear, actually, and we wanted to know what was going on. We found out that they'd bombed Pearl Harbor. That was my first exposure to the war.
You know, and everyone has a story about December 7th. That's the first time I've heard that one. When you saw that smoke coming out of the building, I'm sure you didn't think, oh, Japan just attacked America. You probably had a lot of other stuff going through your mind.
We had no idea what was going on. In fact, we couldn't understand why they pulled these people out of their underwear. There were some of the people that worked for them were there, and they pulled them in as black cars, and off they went. And we sent somebody over to find out what happened, and we found out that they'd bombed Pearl Harbor. And they were trying to burn up their papers at the office.
So the Japanese embassy was trying to destroy any evidence that they knew what was about to take place.
Right.
So how did that impact you? Here you are. I'm sure you had a lot of ideas of what you wanted to do with your life, right?
Well, at first I wanted to be a cook, and that's why I was working for a fast food restaurant, but I found out that wasn't my cup of tea. So shortly after that, I left there. But when I did, I went to work for the CB&Q Railroad in Chicago as an account clerk. And there was quite a few of us, 40 or 50 of us in his office. And the guys at lunchtime would talk about the war and what was going on. And I had made up my mind I wanted to be a fighter pilot in the worst way. And so I went down to the office to check in to that. And I came back rather disappointed because they told me I couldn't join the Air Force because I didn't have a college education. And so then that cut that out for a little while. But shortly after that, they ran an article in the Chicago Tribune said, if you want to become an Air Force pilot, come and take this exam next week. And seven of us from the office went down and took the exam. And I passed the exam and was eligible to go in the Air Force. That's when it all started. I wanted to be a fighter pilot, and so I was ready to go.
Had you seen newsreel footage of some of the fighter planes, or did you follow Charles Lindbergh, or what got you interested in flying like that?
I don't know. I just always enjoyed watching flying, and when I lived in Long Island, we were near an airport, and we saw the airplanes all the time. They low-leveled us a lot, and from that day on, I wanted to be a pilot.
And just about everybody I've ever talked to who was in the U.S. Army Air Corps wanted to be a pilot. Not all of them got to. Were you ever concerned that you might wash out of that demanding program?
All the time I was in there. In fact, I have quite a little story to tell about my experience in the Air Force. I was sent to Wichita Falls, Texas, Shepherd Field, for my beginning training in the service. And I was there 90 days, and they taught us how to wear shoes that didn't fit and that sort of thing. But we were there for 3 months, and from there they transferred me to Nashville, Tennessee, to see whether I could be a fighter pilot or a bombardier or a navigator. And they picked the choice. We were there a couple of weeks. and they said I could be a pilot. So that was started my day off. I was really ready to go. And from there, they sent us to Knoxville, Tennessee, the University of Tennessee, for 5 months. And we had quite a long spell there. It was a very interesting time to be there. I did then get some college education. And they had some of the prettiest girls in the world. We had more fun there. I'll tell you, one of my favorite stories to tell, if I can tell it in a hurry, we lived in a woman's barracks, and on the walls were telephone numbers of all these girls all over Knoxville, Tennessee. And so one day I decided to go on a date, so I found four names and addresses, and I pulled them in back into the room, and I called them up, and I said to one of the four of them, I said, I want to meet you at the corner of so-and-so. I want to go out on a date. She said, that'll be fine. I said, wear something red. Well, I did that three more times, red, blue, green, and yellow, so I could have them stand there and wait for me at a certain time. I set the times, and I went down and picked out the one I wanted. And I've never done it again because I was really embarrassed after I did that. I thought I shouldn't have done that, but it worked well, and I had a good time. But we were at Knoxville for 5 months and got some real good, strict training. And from Knoxville, they sent me to Albany, Georgia, to primary training class. We were there 3 months. There they taught us how to be an officer, a gentleman, and worked us over Army-wise. And then from there, they sent me to Cape Girardeau, Missouri, for my primary training, which is the old Rush Limbaugh home. Anyway, at Cape Girardeau, we flew PT-23s, low-wing aircraft, and it was in the wintertime. It was cold. A lot of days we didn't fly because it was so cold, we'd freeze up in the airplane almost. One of my favorite experiences there was we were out flying one day, and my instructor said, hey, I've been having you drop this airplane in different places by cutting the prop and telling you to land it, and you've been doing pretty well. See how I do. I said, okay. So when I took off and we got over the forest, I thought it was real thick and he couldn't find a place to land, so I cut the prop and said, you're on. And we started down. And as we went down, up ahead of us, I could see these high tension lines that were ahead of us. And I thought, well, he's going to go around them. But he kept going more closer to him. And finally, we got so close that I was about ready to jump out of the plane and frighten the daylights out of me. And all of a sudden, the plane dipped down to the earth and underneath and out the other side. We were underneath those high tension lines. And he never said a word, but he sped back to the airport, and we landed. And when we got out, he got out of the plane. He looked at me. He says, don't you look at things? And I said, what's that, sir? He said, don't you see these? And he pulled off glasses. He said, I can't see well. And that's why we went underneath those high tension lines, because he didn't see them until the last second. And that was one of my most exciting experiences the entire time I was in the Air Force, I think. Anyway, I did get through primary training, normal training that you get in the primary school. And the instructor was a neat guy, and he apologized to me later on for that experience. From Cape Girardeau, Missouri, they sent me to Malden, Missouri for basic training. I flew BT-14s, and they were a high-powered airplane, a noisy airplane. They had a big 450-horsepower engine, and we flew the day, and we learned some night flying in that of those planes also. But the one thing we found out we couldn't do is fly upside down. If you got upside down for more than a few minutes, the fuel dropped out of the plane, and you'd have to land. So we used to have contests between us guys to see who could fly upside down the longest. None of us ever crashed. We all did pretty well. But it was good training for us. And from there, we went to Spencefield, Georgia, Moultrie, Georgia, for advanced flying school and fighter school. And there I was all excited. This was my time. I was in fighter school now. And I was on my sixth hour of training to get ready to solo the following day. And on that particular day, I had a student instructor was with me. They took turns. Some of the students would train with each other on these flights as we did their training. And on that particular day, it was about 95 degrees, and we were told if it was 90 degrees or higher and you were going to come in for a landing, if you found you were overshooting the airport or overshooting the runway, you're going to have to nose it in. Don't do it. Go around, go up around, pull around, come in and do a normal, proper landing. Well, we were going in that day, and it was my sixth hour, and I was a little high, and I started to go around, and my instructor, Barry, said, Ed, I got a date tonight. I want to go out loud. Let me land this thing. And he forced it down in. And so we went down on sort of a nose first forced landing. And on the way in, he just barely tipped the right wing, just touched the grass a little tiny bit. But it was enough for the captain to be waiting for us when we got to the ready room. And he was there, and he said, I want you two to write me a story of what happened and why. I want a 200-word essay from each one of you by 5 o'clock tomorrow morning. And Jones, you're going to go for a check ride, and I'm going to check you out. So he left, and but in the meantime, Barry had told the captain, he said, Captain, he wasn't even flying the plane. He didn't even touch it. He was sitting there when this all happened. The captain says, I don't care. He's going to go for a check ride in the morning. So that night, Barry and I got together, stayed up till 2 in the morning writing 200-word essays, making them different so they wouldn't sound the same. I'd called home, talked to my mom, and tears came. And my dad got on the phone, and he said, well, son, I didn't think you could make it anyway. And so that was a challenge, I guess, that he gave to me. He said, but good luck to you on your ride. Well, that next day, we got there at 5 in the morning. The captain was there. We turned in our essays, and he said, get in the plane. Let's go. So as we were going down the runway, I thought, now, this got to do this perfect. And a normal outlet of a runway, you'd make a 45 to the right, smooth one, and then you go a little ways, a 45 to the left, and you're away from the field. Well, we were going down the runway, and I thought, I got to do this perfect. So, boy, I made a perfect 45 to the right, smooth as could be, and was just about to flip to the left when the plane almost flipped upside down over to the other side. And he had got on the control and flipped the plane over, and he said, I won't use the words, but he used some French words that we don't normally supposed to use. He said, if you want to fly this plane, he said, you fly it. You don't just guide it. And so he gave me back the controls. And then he said, go to check field number 3. Well, that was another challenge. We had 4 check fields there at that time, but I'd only had 6 hours in, so I didn't know which was 1, 2, 3, or 4. He said, go to number 3. So I took off and went to number 3, and luckily, my luck was with me all through the entire Air Force. I hit check field number 3 properly. And as I was landing, I put the wheels down, and we were going in, and he put the wheels back up. And so then I put them down again, and we landed. And we parked at the end of the field, and there was several other pilots there with their cadets. Planes were parked around. And he said, I'll be back in a few minutes. And he said, you get ready to go for some more check ride. While he was gone, it ended up being 2 hours. And he really made me sweat because I smoked cigarettes then in those days. And I smoked all the Camels I had in my pocket. Then I picked up a leaf and rolled it and smoked it. So, in fact, I told a story not long ago to some people at the boot camp here in Hanford. And after I got done, one of the boys said, did you smoke weeds in those days? The leaf I had rolled. Anyway, he came back, and we took off, went back to the field. He said, let's go back to the field. So we took it back to the field. And as we got close to the field, he said, well, you solo tomorrow, so land us in good, and you're on your way. So we landed, and as we got there, I noticed that the ready room was full of cadets standing at attention, waiting inside to have a meeting. And we got out of the plane, went into the meeting, and as we got in there, they said they have an announcement to make that if you are 6 foot tall or taller, you are going to twin engine school. Apparently, they had come up with enough pilots now for fighter pilots. They needed some tall pilots, so I shrunk, but it didn't work. They said, Jones, we know you're 6 foot tall. So off I went to advanced training in the bomber school at Albany, Georgia, which was right close to Spence Field. By the way, this Spence Field had a beautiful hangar with a big S on top that saved my life a little while later.
Well, let me ask you, while you're in that point in your story, was that a disappointment to you? Because here you told me you dreamed of being a fighter pilot, and now they're saying, you know, in this day of discrimination based on whatever, they're saying, you're too tall to do that. You've got to do what we say you're going to do. Was that hard for you? Did you just kind of accept it?
You're the first one I've told this to, but I got tears in my eyes. I wanted to be a fighter pilot. I just couldn't wait to be a fighter pilot. That was the most exciting thing that's going to happen to me. But I thought, well, if I could stay in the Air Force, or at least I didn't get washed out. So I got a big thrill by passing getting to go to the bomber school. And we went through our training there in AT-10s. It was called the Bamboo Bomber. It was made out of bamboo. And so we did our training in the Bamboo Bomber. And I had a good buddy. In fact, Barry, the student instructor that was with me the day we had the solo problem, he was my partner, and we flew together all around Georgia. And several of the things that happened were kind of exciting. One of them was we were supposed to go to a trans-state flight from Albany, where we were, to Atlanta, and then back to Elgin and back home on a night flight. And he was going to be the navigator, and I would be the pilot. Well, we took off, and they called us back about after we got out of 4 or 5 minutes and said, there's a storm coming, return to the field. And being hotshot cadets, Barry looked at me and I looked at him and thought, well, we can make it. We're going to go anyway. And we did go. And the only reason we got to Atlanta, it was so much light in Atlanta, you could see through the storm clouds where Atlanta was. Then we turned and came back to Elgin, and we were about two-thirds of the way back when Barry said, Ed, I'm lost. And I said, well, so am I, because I don't know where we're at. I don't know where we're supposed to be, but I don't know where we're at. So we started looking for an airport or lights or something, and finally we saw this big S on top of this hangar. And I said to Barry, we're going home. He said, what do you mean? I said, I'm going home. He said, how do you know? I said, look at that S down there. That's Spence Airfield. And it was. And so by being there, I knew, and he knew, but he didn't realize it was Spence Field. And we got home with about 5 minutes of gas left and stood and listened to an hour of lectures that we went when we shouldn't have gone, but we got through it all right. And the only other thing that happened there that was pretty exciting was one day we're out flying, and all these airplanes had a top speed limit that they could make, and you weren't supposed to go faster than that. And this one was, I forgot the speed now, but it was probably 240 miles an hour or something like that. And I said, let's see how fast this plane will really go. So we went into a dive, and as we were diving down, we got up as high as we could. We were probably at 10,000 feet. Went into a dive and got about a minute into the dive, and Barry's canopy flew off. And he reached up and grabbed it. He was going to jump, and I hollered, don't jump. I still got control of the plane. So he settled back down, and we got back down to the airport with the canopy blown off. We had to explain that, and it was pretty hard to explain. If we'd explained it properly, we'd have got washed out, I'm sure.
So what kind of creative story did you come up with to account for the missing canopy?
Well, we said the engine lost power, and we couldn't get it going fast enough. And it finally, it got down. And when we got down low, it started again. They believe this, I think, but I'm not sure. Because even the straps on the wings on both sides were sagging down, and the plane was in pretty bad shape, I think, when we got there. But we didn't tell them what happened. We just left it at the ready shop.
Well, we'll leave your story right there for a minute because it's time for our first commercial break. Ed Jones, if you know him in Hanford, wish him a 90th birthday Tuesday, will you? When we come back, we'll move on from Ed's training days to the 11 missions he flew in Europe as a B-24 pilot in World War II, including the one that left him with a pretty unique souvenir he still has today. Hometown Heroes continues right after this on KMJ.
A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We have been entertained so far by Ed Jones of Hanford, California. He'll turn 90 this Tuesday, but back in his early 20s, he was flying B-24 Liberators over Europe. On our website at kmjnow.com, you'll find a picture that Ed shared of a B-24 cockpit. And now he had to be able to point to each instrument on that panel and identify it blindfolded. If you want to see an instrument panel like that for yourself, don't forget Open Cockpit Day is coming up at Castle Air Museum in Atwater. You can get inside the B-24 there and pretend you're our guest today if you like. Open Cockpit Day is 4 weeks from tomorrow on September 2nd. That instrument memorization was part of the intense training Ed went through in becoming a bomber pilot. And so far, Ed, you haven't taken us overseas, so let's move in that direction if we can.
So anyway, we graduated from advanced flying school, and they said, well, you're graduated now, and you're going to... And by the way, I graduated as a flight officer. They had second lieutenants and flight officers, and I was rather disappointed because I wanted to be a second lieutenant. And I didn't find out till years after the war that the reason I got a flight officer, I didn't have a college education. And so if you didn't have a college, you got a flight officer instead of a second lieutenant. And they sent us to Marchfield, Riverside, California, to training school for overseas. And while I was there, they gave me my advance to second lieutenant. And it turned out to be very well because I went overseas as an enlisted man, which a flight officer was. An enlisted man got 10% increase in pay over the regular pay. So I got a second lieutenant's pay plus 10%. Kind of nice. But I had a little quick stop before I got to Riverside. They sent me to Lemoore, California to a relocation center to pick up my crew. And we were there 2 weeks. It was in the wintertime. And then the second week I was there, Harry James was playing at the Civic Auditorium in Hanford, and Hanford used to have big bands every week almost. And so I went into the Civic Auditorium to the band to see Harry James. And as I met the front door, I was met by a hostess and a co-hostess, Mary Lou and Doris, Doris Freitas, Mary Lou Bairstow, and they took us into the dance. And we spent the night, I spent the night there at the dance, dancing until I had to go and get on the truck and head back home. Well, I became rather enthralled with one of the hostesses, and before I left Riverside, California, I let her know that I wanted to see her again. But anyway, I went to Riverside, California, Marchfield, where we did our training over the Mojave Desert. We did low level, we did high level, with 20,000 feet quite often, and a lot of training. We did gunnery training, and everything you do in a B-24, we did it, getting ready to go overseas. And after 3 months there, why, they sent us to Boston, Massachusetts, Miles Standish Air Base in Boston, Massachusetts, and I'm going overseas now. Do you want me to go ahead?
Well, I have some more questions about the B-24, because I've talked to a lot of guys who've flown those planes, and some of them have said, oh, it was no big deal, and other guys have said, you needed some real physical strength to be able to take off in a B-24. How did you find the B-24? How did it handle for you, and was it easy to get used to flying that big hunk of iron?
No, it wasn't. It was rather frightening because it was super large. In fact, it had a big cockpit the co-pilot sat in. In fact, I showed you a picture a little while ago of the cockpit, and it had must be 40, 50 instruments in there. And you had to, before we could fly our B-24s, did I go to Harlingen, Texas yet? I didn't go there. Well, excuse me, I jumped ahead of myself. I went to Harlingen, Texas for co-pilot training, and it's down on the Gulf of Mexico. And before they'd let us fly one of those planes, we had to be able to identify all the instruments in the cockpit on your side blindfolded. And it took a long amount of time to do that. And then they let us fly on the co-pilot side for a little while. Then they let us fly on the pilot side. But to answer your question earlier, it was like flying a Mack truck. They were heavy, hard to fly. It took all you got to fly the darn things because they were cable-driven. They weren't anything easy to fly. But they were fun to fly because they did what you told them to, except that it was a big job. We flew over the Gulf of Mexico a lot and bombed a lot of fishermen visually. But we were there for 3 months, and then I went from there to Lemoore Air Base. But we got all of my basic training on B-24s at Harlingen, Texas, and that used to be called a Confederate Air Base, which some of you may have heard of. But anyway, we go back to Marchfield, and after 3 months at Marchfield, they sent me to Miles Standish, Boston, Massachusetts, and we got ready to go overseas. They were going to ship us overseas on the USS United States. It was the newest ocean liner. We had just been completed for passenger traffic, and they made it a liner for sending us overseas. And when we went over without escort, and we were the first group of anybody to go overseas without escort because of the submarines. But the submarine scare had pretty well worn out. Germans had lost most of their submarines.
When was this? What was about the timing of when you went overseas?
December of 44, the first part of December, the 5th of December, I got to in England. And we went from there to our air base at Attlebridge with 466 Bomb Group. And it was pretty exciting. There was 10 of us in the crew, and I had a great crew. We had an engineer, a navigator, a bombardier, gunners, scope runners, a microscope, which we took pictures with to do our dropper bombs, and a pilot and a navigator, and a pilot and a co-pilot. So we had a good crew. And we were put in barracks that were about as run down and as bad shape as you ever saw in your life. And we were there, as I say, in December, and it was pretty cold. And that's the last I had a cold shower for 3 months because they didn't have hot showers in those days. So it was quite a thrill to take a shower every day. We didn't take them all the time because it was cold. And then when we went to the down to the runway, we had to get on a bicycle and ride to the runway to go on our missions. And it was quite an experience. We learned a lot of things. If you got scrambled eggs or dried eggs in the morning for breakfast, it meant you weren't going on a mission. If you got regular fried eggs up, fried sunny side up, you were going on a mission. So we knew about that. But they'd get us up at 4 in the morning and brief us on what our target was going to be and where we were going and how long the target would take and so on. And it was quite interesting because they were always very, very accurate.
Before your first mission, do you remember feeling anxious, nervous, excited? What do you remember about what that felt like to be ready to go up in the air and go bomb the Germans?
Well, I had no idea except that I knew it was going to be we were told we were going to Magdeburg, Germany. In fact, my first three missions were Magdeburg, Germany, and they were the longest missions that I made during the whole war. I didn't know what flak looked like. They didn't know what it sounded like or if it sounded like anything or what we were going to see when we got there. And we didn't know about fighter planes. They were, of course, pretty well diminished by then, but we didn't know that. They didn't tell us that. And so on my first mission, it was a complete whole new aspect of my life. And we hit a ton of flak on the first mission that really kept us awake and aware of our missions from then on, because flak was pretty scary looking. It bluish purple, looked like fireworks, all those black float clouds. And when one went off close to the plane bounced pretty heavily, and you knew that you were right in that area. In fact, they had three types of flak. They had box flak, ghost flak, and just regular flak. The box flak, the Germans would figure out where we were going to do our run to drop our bombs, and if they could figure it out, then they'd move all their portable gunnery flak. They had a lot of gunnery flak, portable, and they'd put it on in one spot and just shoot it up into it, looked like a box, and you had to fly through it, because once you took off from your initial point to the target, the bombardier was in control of the plane, and he let it in, and he couldn't go up or down or right or left. You had to go straight into the target, so you knew if the flak was near you, why you'd see some of it. And it was pretty exciting. It was scary. We didn't want to be bombed out. And my first three missions were Magdeburg. The second mission, the lead navigator got 50 miles off course, and we went through the heaviest flak I saw during the entire war. It was just thick flak. You could hear it, see it, and so on.
So here you are. I imagine, being a pilot, you feel some responsibility for the lives of the other 9 men on your plane?
You feel complete responsibility for them, and you want to make sure you do the right thing and don't make a mistake that would be fatal to anybody on the crew.
But here you are, and you know you're going to fly through a huge cloud of flak. So as those moments are unfolding, what do you do? How do you try to stay focused? How do you pass that time? What's going on in your mind and in your body as your plane is basically going through what could be an execution?
Well, when the bombardier had the control of the plane, it was pretty horrifying because you sat there. You knew you wanted to get the control and take over and fly it yourself because you thought you could do better than anybody else could. But you knew you couldn't, and you had to sit there with your hands folded or crossed or fingers crossed. And I've forgotten how many minutes it was, but it was probably about a 5-minute run on this course that you went through, that box of flak that you had to go whether you wanted to or not. And you prayed a little bit. I prayed a lot.
And you had some close calls too, whether you knew it initially or not.
Oh yeah, you had close calls. In fact, I have a piece of flak that hit my airplane on one of the missions, and it came through and knocked a hole in the plane, and the airplane body wrapped around the flak. It was only a small one, but when I got home from the mission, we landed, and I got up to check out, and I had a Captain Haig. He was older than I was. He was probably in his 30s, but a good guy, and he really listened to me all the time, and he was a good man. But he said, "Sit down." I said, "What's the matter?" He said, "Look on the floor." And I looked over to my right, and I saw this hole in the airplane. I could see outside and a piece of flak on the floor. And I said, "Why the didn't you tell me?" And he said, "You'd have bailed out." And anyway, that was the only piece of flak that ever hit our plane, but it was kind of scary when I saw it afterwards. I didn't see it when it happened, but I'm glad I didn't, because I would have been concerned about it all the way home probably.
And you have it here. I'm going to put a picture of it on our website at kmjnow.com. But that's a pretty decent-sized piece of flak, and that's actually part of the aluminum of the aircraft wrapped around it?
The aircraft that wrapped around the flak that hit the plane, yes, uh-huh. It was strong enough and heavy enough that if it had hit by the window, it would have hit me, and I would have got it instead of the floor and the body of the plane. The body of the plane saved us in this particular case because it was right by my right knee. But it landed on the floor.
And that is the hallmark of the B-24, right? Its ability to take a pounding in the air. Is that something that you and your crew took pride in, that your plane could take quite a pounding?
Yes, it was. We used to brag about the fact that we could go over and come back and we'd be back even though there was a lot of flak. And there was a lot of flak, and there was a lot of airplanes in the sky. It's a wonder. To this day, I'm not sure why we didn't collide with some of them, because the English flew at night, and we flew in the daytime. We flew missions in formation. Sometimes one of them was up to 1,000 planes in the sky at one time. But as we were coming in at night, the English were taking off singly in their airplanes. And I have to hand it to them. They went singly at night and dropped their bombs. And how we didn't collide once in a while, I'll never know. Maybe we did, but I didn't hear about it. But our plane was a rugged plane, the B-24. It was a super plane. And by the way, we were talking about flying one. About halfway through the war, they were cable-driven airplanes. And then they went they got rid of the cables and put in power steering. And the plane flew like a glider then. It was just a delight to fly. You couldn't find a hard day with a B-24 with a power steering in it. And it really made the plane just a superb airplane. We were there from December of 44 until June of 45. And I should have been home in February of 45, because you'd have your 30 missions in 2 to 3 months time. But sometime where during the training period, during a bombing period, we made several runs, one just before Christmas Day, and they decided that we were going to be a lead crew for all the missions, and so we had to go through training. We flew over England, up 400 feet over England, many, many hours practicing, training. But the training period took us away from the bomber schedule, so that, as I say, we only got 11 missions in that amount of time. We should have had 30 in within 60 days.
But you're not complaining that you flew 11 instead of 30, because more than twice the missions means more than twice the chance of getting shot down and being a POW or killed, right?
Oh, I was whistling in the dark. That was pretty neat. Yeah, no, I was pleased. It was kind of neat to be a training crew or lead crew. In fact, one thing happened on one of our missions that I was surprised at. I was flying the plane. The captain let me fly most of the time, which was nice of him because it gave me a lot of training. And one day we were on a mission, I forget what town we were going to, and I felt like I was leaving the flock of planes. And so I started steering to the left, and the captain grabbed the wheel and says, "I got it," and I let go. And on that particular mission, we were up at 20,000 feet. We had clouds above and clouds below and no horizon. And I got a case of vertigo, which I've never had in my life. But it only lasted for a short period of time. But if he hadn't been there and got the wheels, we'd have gone through all the planes in the squadron.
Wow.
Yeah, it was quite an excitement thing.
If you're only going to experience vertigo one time in your life, that's probably the worst possible time to go through that.
Couldn't have been worse. Yeah, it was a bad time to happen, but luckily the captain saw something was wrong and took over immediately. He was a good pilot, and we got out of it all right.
Well, we're glad you did, and glad the show's not over yet. More with B-24 pilot Ed Jones when Hometown Heroes comes right back. Don't forget to visit our website, kmjnow.com, and see what Ed looked like back in World War II. You can also see what he looks like now and see that piece of flak that reminds him of a close call over Europe. You'll find a whole gallery of photos relating to Ed's service if you pull up Hometown Heroes on Facebook. And the rest of Ed's story, including how he ended up back in Kings County after the war, when Hometown Heroes continues next on KMJ.
For years, Paso Robles has been known for the Mid-State Fair and its world-class wineries. Coming Saturday, September 29th, a new event will join those two. Estrella Warbird Museum, in conjunction with the Plains of Fame Air Museum, presents Warbirds Over Paso. Thrill to the roar of P-51 Mustangs, a P-38 Lightning, F-4U Corsair, and even a North American B-25 Bomber. Tour the C-47, a true veteran of World War II, and see many more in breathtaking flybys. See the world's only N-9M Flying Wing, forerunner of the B-2 stealth bomber. Warbird rides available before and after the flying display. Gates open 8 a.m. Admission $20. Active duty military and kids under 12 free. Admission includes open house at the museum, free parking, food and beverage vendors on site. Sponsored in part by Firestone Walker Brewing Company, it's Warbirds Over Paso, Saturday, September 29th at the Paso Robles Municipal Airport on Airport Road off Highway 46. Call 805-277-0440 or go to ewarbirds.org/airshow.
Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Las Banas at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Las Banas every once in a while. So next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Las Banas.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Ed Jones of Hanford has taken us on a journey from Chicago on Pearl Harbor Day all the way to the skies over Germany in his B-24. And there was that fateful Air Corps detour that first brought him to the San Joaquin Valley.
Here this guy from Chicago and New York City ends up in Lemoore, California for a couple weeks, and you meet a girl at the door of the auditorium, and you said you told her you were going to see her again. Does that mean you were writing letters while you were overseas, or were you just hoping you might see her again?
I was just hoping I might see her again. I don't think we wrote any letters until I got home.
Those 11 missions, you've told me about a few of them. We talked about the flak that you have among your great mementos from the war, including a couple air medals and some great photographs that we'll put at kmjnow.com. Any other moments from those 11 missions that really stand out in your memory where you felt that adrenaline or you felt something different could have happened, or maybe even that you were just doing something worthwhile? What else do you remember about those 11 missions?
Well, one of the missions went to Halle, Germany, and we were about ready to jump the Rhine, and apparently the United States decided they were going to bomb everything they could in Germany that was available, and they sent us into Halle, Germany at 1,000 feet, and we dropped our bombs. And when you got there to the target, we knew it was going to be a scary one, because when you're that low and dropping bombs, you could see people running, you see cars moving, and it was quite frightful. We didn't know whether they had flak there or not, or gunners or whatever. But that was probably one of the scariest missions I had of the whole war. And it was the only one we did at 1,000 feet. The rest of them were at 20,000 feet.
Yeah, boy. And to not know whether they have anti-aircraft artillery down there or not, you must have been holding your breath.
We were holding it very highly. Yeah, we didn't know that. And the only other mission that I can remember that I had something to remember by, we dropped bombs on a city just this side of Switzerland, on a Switzerland border, and our plane had a what they call a Mickey scope, which took pictures of the ground underneath and made outlines of, it had cities of all the cities in Germany and all in that area. And we dropped bombs on this one city in Germany, we thought, and the whole outfit dropped the bombs on it. And when we got home, we heard that there was a real bad mistake, that we dropped the bombs on the wrong city. We dropped them on Switzerland. And it happened that there were two cities next to each other that were almost identical borders, and so the scope showed a picture of one that looked like German, and it was Switzerland. And it cost the United States $8 million in fines for that mission that the whole group made, not just us.
Did that bother you? Was that hard to hear?
Yeah, Yes, it did. It did. We had to bomb the wrong place, and we were surprised that our scope wasn't working. We thought working better than that, but we could see how it could happen.
So as you're getting nearer and nearer to the end of the war, did you have a sense that this was about over, that Germany was about to surrender?
Yes, I did. In fact, about our eighth mission, I think it was our eighth mission, my waist gunner called up and he said, "Hey, Jones, Lieutenant Jones, there's a plane outside of us without a prop on it." And I said, "What are you talking about?" And he said, "Well, look." And I looked over and here was a German plane with a swastika and no prop on it. And the pilot, you could see him. He was that close to us, flying parallel to us. And about the time I looked, then he took off and went down below. And it was a German fighter plane, jet plane. They had gotten their jet planes started, and that's why all of our missions but two were to ball bearing factories, because we knew they were building jets. We didn't want to have any ball bearings to build them with, so we wanted to cut down their production. But when I saw that jet plane, that was the only one I saw during the war. The rest of them were regular fighter planes. I thought, we may still have a longer war than we're gonna have, but we didn't have.
Well, and I'm assuming that you didn't even know that technology existed, right?
I had no idea. In fact, I don't know if I had ever heard the word jet before. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know that technology existed, no. And everybody says, "Well, why didn't he shoot you?" Well, I have no idea. All I know is that by the time I looked, he dove down and started firing at the squadron below us. Mm-hmm. But I was told that the reason he didn't stay up very long is that at that time they could only stay up for a few minutes. They'd run out of fuel, so they had to get up and get down in a hurry. That was one of their problems.
But you're not complaining that he didn't shoot at you?
Oh, no, I'm glad. Yeah, no, I was just surprised to see the swastika, could see the pilot. I thought, my gosh, we're in this war real good yet.
You're talking, of course, about the world's first military jet, the ME-262. There were some predecessors as the Germans experimented with jet engine technology. And while we're on that topic, a little peek ahead here. There's a big air show coming up in Paso Robles at the end of next month. In fact, you probably heard a commercial for it a little bit ago. Right before that air show at the end of September, I hope to have as a guest on this program a gentleman who lives on the Central Coast who ended up flying in the U.S. Air Force, but as a teenager in Germany was actually a test pilot in those early jets. So looking forward to that next month. But back to your story now, Ed. When the war ended, what did that mean to you? And what was the atmosphere like among you and your crew and your fellow airmen?
Well, I think we were all excited to get home. We could see that we were winning the war. We were dropping bombs without flak in a lot of places where they had run out of flak and run out of airplanes and so on. So we could see that we were winning the war. And although the frightful flak never got away from us, so every mission you made, you had to kind of hold your breath and hope you didn't get shot at. I was kind of glad the war ended there because I wanted to go to fly B-29s, and I'd heard I had qualified for B-29 school, and we wanted to go to Asia to finish the war over there. And so we were kind of glad to see this war ending so we could go to Asia.
But you didn't go to Asia. What changed your plans?
Well, what changed my plan probably is marriage. I came back home and got married shortly after I got home, and they had told me I could join the Air Force again if I wanted to. And in fact, Hamilton Field sent me a letter, told me to come up on a certain day to get back in the Air Force. But in the meantime, I had gotten married and had a youngster on the way. And I thought, I just can't do that to a family. If I want to stay in a war, I'll get divorced. I didn't want to do that. So the marriage changed my direction.
That marriage grew out of the 2 weeks that you spent in Lemoore way back when, because you came back to Kings County to marry the girl you had met at the auditorium, right?
That's right. That's right. Yes, I did. Uh-huh. Yeah. I came back to live in Hanford, which is a great town and always has been, always will be. It's one of the finest towns in the whole world.
And you've been in Hanford ever since, now with your wife of 41 years, Maxine. What has it meant to you to be in this community for so long and also to see how Hanford honors guys like you who were willing to put your lives on the line?
Well, I was truly thrilled when you called me on the phone the other day and said you were coming by to interview me because, let's face it, we all have a little bit of ego about us, and it raised my ego 1,000% to know that I was going to be interviewed for the radio. I was glad I was able to help out in the war and glad I was able to get back and do what I'm doing now. I love Hanford, and I'm going to look forward to it the rest of my life.
And for many years, like so many veterans, especially in the World War II generation, you didn't talk about those missions. You didn't talk about the piece of flak and your takeoffs and landings and the close calls. You didn't break out all these pictures all the time and explain to people. But a few years ago, that changed. What prompted you to start telling your story? Did you just realize that this was history that was going to die with you?
Well, probably Rotary Club got me started on it. I joined Rotary. Bill Bannister, who is not here any longer, got me to join Rotary. And oh, by the way, I belong to Rotary now since 1988, and I've never missed a meeting. I got perfect attendance. But Rotary Club one day asked me to tell my war stories. And I didn't want to do it because I didn't think it was worth doing. All of us veterans, it wasn't something that we were out looking to do at the time. And so they got me to give my little talk, and I typed it up on a typewriter and gave it to them, and they all enjoyed it. And I was amazed at the amount of information I had brought home. I've got gear, I've got flak, I got two boxes full of uniforms and things that I don't know how I ever got home, but I got home with them. And so I thought, well, if they enjoyed it at Rotary, someone else might. So I do go out and give little talks now and then whenever someone asks me, because I feel like I'm doing it. I know the boot camp got two of them from me, and they just loved it, and I felt like I'm doing some good for people.
And when you go and talk to these groups, what's the number one message that you want them to come away with?
I want them to come away with the fact that you can be whatever you want to be if you'll just make up your mind you're going to do it, and study hard and listen to school. If you'll take any training that comes your way, take it and absorb it and use it.
Do you ever find yourself looking back at some of the things you experienced as a pilot and wondering how different it could have been if one thing changed? I mean, you had some pretty close calls. How do you figure all that out now when you look back at it? Do you feel fortunate to have survived everything you went through?
I always feel like I'm on top of the world. Even sitting here with you right now visiting, I feel like I was the luckiest man in the whole wide world to have gone as far as I went and to be where I'm at today. And if I were to ask to do it over again, I would do it over again. The only thing, I would become a fighter pilot somehow.
So what would be your plane of choice if you had been a fighter pilot in World War II?
Oh, I wanted to fly a P-47.
Yeah?
Yeah, that was my favorite plane. I wanted to be a P-47 pilot. Of course, today the jet planes, they're a lot different. I'd want to be a jet pilot, but I'd like to be a P-47 pilot.
Well, the P-47, like the B-24, took a pretty good pounding, too, and kept coming home. Is there anything else that you want us to know about your time in World War II and everything you did for our country?
No, I just want to thank Uncle Sam for taking such good care of the soldiers in this service. I just think he did a great job, and every once in a while I get a little bit concerned about the government giving everything to youngsters nowadays, and I'm not in favor of that. But I think if they were doing something worthwhile and earning it, then it would be worthwhile. And I want to thank Uncle Sam for taking care of Ed Jones, and he did a great job of it.
You're going to be 90 this week. What keeps you going? You have a youthful exuberance about you. You don't seem 90. I know people listening can hear that in your voice, and I get comments a lot if a guy is of a certain age but doesn't sound like it, and I'm sure I'm going to get those comments this week. So what's your secret to staying so young?
Well, I'm happy to be alive. I find out if something happened to you and it works out all right, to keep going. I've had both my knees replaced and I still can walk. I have a super, super wife who loved to go on trips. We went on many, many trips together. She's been a great gal. Maxine has been the greatest gal in the world to me, and would have been to anybody, I'm sure, but I lucked out and got her. And we've been married, we'll be 42 years this year.
Well, happy early anniversary and happy 90th birthday come Tuesday. That's Ed Jones of Hanford, California. Check out his photos at kmjnow.com and join us again next Saturday for another edition of Hometown Heroes on KMJ.